multinational corporations dancing on the ruins. Multinational corporations dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Ha, 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 ha. Say goodbye to plastic and goodbye to cars. No more convenience stores. Hello to stars. No more Wall Street and no more Pentagon. Thinking about these things makes me happy. Multinational corporations dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Ha, 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 ha. Goodbye to polystyrene, we'll put it into the waste. There is no time for debating, we have to make haste. If we're going to survive without computer program minds, we're going to have to can pop culture. Multinational corporations, ha, 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 ha. Sayonara to suburbia and well-manicured lawns. Bye-bye Barbie and Ken doll pawns. No more developers or slime ball execs. Your condos are on fire. Multinational corporations, ha, 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 ha. No more a Christian country, we'll have pagan deities. And when we've destroyed technology, we all will be free. The pavement will be ripped up and the skyscrapers cut down. Yes, we are coming for your children. Multinational corporations dancing on the ruins of multinational corporations. Ha, ha.
Dancing on the Ruins of Multinational Corporations by Casey Neal on his disc titled Riffraff, and I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. I was in Seattle for the WTO protest. I had no planning role and went as an individual marching with an anti-imperialist group. The diversity of people protesting and the different tactics they used was truly dazzling. While today many agree that the protests in Seattle were a turning point for what is often called the anti-globalization movement, there is still ongoing controversy about the tactics used on November 30th and in the days following. What tactics used by protesters were appropriate? Should some of them have been prevented? You only had to have open eyes to see the different tactics used. Traditional protest tactics included literally dozens of marches, huge permitted ones and many smaller unpermitted ones. They marched into downtown Seattle from every possible route on the morning of November 30th, 1999. And when they got there, they found a downtown transformed overnight by direct action affinity groups. And their tactics were on display for all to see. Major intersections were locked down by groups of activists chained to huge concrete freeway dividers they had somehow managed to place in the middle of the Seattle skyscrapers. Rows of trucks and buses were used to surround and block other areas to prevent anyone from getting to the site of the WTO. The tactics had an immediate and dramatic effect. Seattle looked like it was really shutting down, and the police were already there with tear gas and concussion grenades. Some marches tried to avoid these areas, while others went to chant support for the people locked down. Nearby, groups of Korean farmers sat down in formation in a public square, as did members of the Chinese religious group the Falun Gong. As the day progressed, Black Bloc anarchists entered the fray with targeted property destruction. They one by one took down plate glass windows of large corporations. This tactic has a long tradition in Europe, where dressing alike in black hooded sweatshirts and masks was used by anarchists both to evade identification by police and to promote equality within the ranks. Property destruction as a tactic has an American history as well, in the labor movement and in the anti-war movement of the 60s and 70s, when the Weather Underground did a series of targeted bombings, including the bombing of the U.S. Capitol. The weathermen actions were always targeted at property and carried out to ensure no harm to people. It's safe to say, however, that their actions were not widely popular, and the jury is still out on their effectiveness. And in Seattle that day, on occasion, protesters squared off against each other. Those who saw property destruction as a form of violence trying to stop those who were using it. What follows are the voices of some of those from both sides, looking back and describing that day. Faye Kalias is an independent media producer and a proud advocate of property destruction as an appropriate tactic in the face of imperialism. Here he reads his recollection of Seattle, recorded for us by KABU reporter Maggie Starr.
In the back of a truck on a rainy winter day, we pull off I-5 into Seattle. High in the distance, a banner hangs from a crane building condos. WTO this way, democracy that. A guy holding incense flashing a victory sign greets cars as they go into downtown. We find our friends, the house we would be staying in for the week of the convention. This house near downtown became our trenches. We ate from cans of beans with pocket knives. I was here to take pictures. I had been part of demonstrations in the months leading up to the WTO. I captured images on film with an old Nikon F my father had given me. On our first night, we plastered a Starbucks with political posters. These posters were tokens of the revolution. This was before 9/11, so things felt hopeful. Environmental activists and union activists coming together in unity, in solidarity. On the first day, I saw in the distance a light haze. This was my first taste of tear gas. The haze, barely visible, hit hard. I instantly could not see or breathe, just like all those around me. Rows of riot police blocked all the ways out. People panicking. I was able to jump through a gap of riot cops. I saw kids rolling dumpsters and SWAT teams with submachine guns. Delegates for the meetings running about, believing they own the world. A squadron of riot police was coming up the street, hitting their batons on riot shields in unison, a clack, clack that echoed and rang in the tight buildings of downtown. Every moment you turned, something profound was happening. I saw a woman on her knees in a business suit praying in the middle of an intersection. She had blood pouring from her head. Police were cornering and beating people all around. Then the windows came down. As I walked this surreal scene, an alarm is going off at a jewelry store. All the windows smashed. Capitol was in the process of being smashed. None of the jewelry was touched. Symbolic crime. The thin veneer of control Capitol believes it has over the people was shattered in an instant. A guy with a handgun shoots rounds into an unattended squad car. Watch this. Blam, blam. Long live that guy. I look down off of a plaza and see cops putting on gas masks, helmets. Even the horses had riot face shields and gas masks. I'd never seen this kind of equipment used before. This was the first time. This was the introduction of this gear at a protest during our generation. During previous protests, police just wore blue jeans and leather gloves to beat people. People are sitting, blocking an access bridge. It's early on the first morning, cold, but the sun is out and bright. All are somber and subdued. A girl begs me to stay as a witness. Police line up behind the people all sitting. I run down an off-ramp below the bridge. A cop tries to stop me. I tell the cop to back away and hold my ground. Nothing behind me. This is my way out. A steep hill. The cop goes back to the skirmish line. I follow. Now I'm behind the police. The riot police count down. They start bashing the ribs of the people sitting with their arms linked. The police rip off gas masks from a girl, then hold her down and spray mace, forcing her open eyes. This quickly became a torture scene. Police throw the gas mask towards me, not realizing I'm there. I grab the mask, then a red used can of police mace falls at my feet. People in front of the protest line are throwing full cans of soda that are hitting the ground hard all around me. Almost being hit, I grab the police mace. I yell to the commanding officer, "Sir, sir, is this the brand you use?" I hold up the cop mace to spray him in the face. A small amount of pressure is still in the can. Fear falls over the commander's eyes. I had him. I disappear down my escape route. I climb a hill of bushes and trees and jump into throngs of people, unaware, and disappear into the crowds. Now I have a gas mask for the coming days of battle with police. Years later, I saw footage of that scene. In that footage, a woman cop in riot gear is breaking down and crying because the torture she and her comrades were doing. Then the windows came crashing down. I remember specifically after seeing this that the windows came down after the people's blood was shed and was glad for that. After seeing that so early in the protest, break them all. Symbolic crime, smash all those evil windows. Why not? That crying cop knew, and I knew, this was the first skirmish. This was the defining moment of truth. Long arcs of tear gas canisters are lobbed high through the night sky. People scramble, picking them up, throwing the gas canisters back. There is a dumpster burning, tipped over in the middle of the street. I hide behind it as riot police close in. I stand to take a picture. A bright light from the police shines on me. A lit tear gas canister hits me hard in the gut. Then a cop slowly rolls a shock grenade towards me. It goes off at my feet, in my face. The cap bounces off my gas mask. I snap another shot, then get out fast. If the bright light shines on you, you're being targeted. If you have a gas mask, then throw them all back. Downtown Seattle is declared a complete war zone. Our clothes are permeated in pepper mace and tear gas. We try to sleep in front of the jail in solidarity. A squat has already been raided. I go up to the university district. People are pulling bricks out of the sidewalk. How French, I thought. There is a hill on two sides. A silver police van is skidding in circles in the middle of the intersection. Pepper spray shooting from its windows. Like an old cop movie, people jump out of the way. Police line up at the bottom of the hill. I duck into a bus shelter. Rubber bullets bounce off everything. A war zone. A cloud of gas pours over the people. With my mask, I am able to hide in the thick tear gas. I go over to a KFC. I smash the window. Half of the people chase me. "We're going to kill you," I yelled back. "Stop Kentucky Fried Chicken," some yelled out in my defense. As I got out of the area, a couple asked me what was going on. I replied, "Anything you want. The revolution?" With a gas mask, I was able to get into downtown during martial law. It was all tear gas and quiet streets. People had fled all of this area. A cloud of poison gas. All the city buses were loaded up with zip-tied people to be taken to a mass arrest camp called Sand Point. I had heard the most distressing stories of people held in those jails. Years later, each person that gave their real name during the arrests was given $5,000, since all the arrests were en masse and were illegal. This was the first mass arrest of our generation. This was the first use of riot gear of our generation. The Union shut down all the ports in the world, and the anarchists smashed the windows of capital. For one day, we all saved this world together. We had them all complete victory, no matter the cost. If all this evidence of corporate slavery is presented and you are still against people struggle, your mind won't be changed. You are my enemy. No one deserves success if others are oppressed. art must be made by any means necessary.
That was Faye Kalius, independent media producer. Next, we'll hear from S.W. Konser with a different take on the role of property destruction that day.
Hi, I'm S.W. Konser, and in 1999, I was a morning news anchor for KABU. On November 30th, I was in downtown Seattle, up close and personal with both the police and the protesters, with a good view of the interactions. And while I think the discussion of tactics and property damage is a really important one, it's also a bit idealistic. There's a practical consideration in street protest, which is that the authorities can very easily manipulate the situation, which is pretty much exactly what happened on November 30th. The scene in downtown Seattle on the morning of that first day was absolutely peaceful, and in fact, there was a bunch of community building going on. The peaceful protesters, who were the vast majority of the crowd, were actually going out of their way to protect property. They were leaning against buildings, blocking windows from any vandals, anybody with spray paint or rocks or bricks. And this situation held for hours. Now, these stable situations would get broken up time and time again by the police, who would fire tear gas into the crowds of peaceful protesters, moving them back away from the street. What would happen at that point is masked protesters would come into the crowd and start breaking windows. The police, interestingly enough, rarely fired any chemical weaponry at the folks with black masks. They would come in, they would do what they wanted to do, which was some vandalism. And once the gas cleared up, the peaceful protesters would come back in, you know, try to protect property again, and they'd get fired upon once more. The interesting thing about the mask protesters, the Black Bloc and others, is how open they were. They would traipse from block to block, drumming in compact formation. And what you have to realize during November 30th is that the President of the United States was on his way to Seattle. So clearly there was a huge security detail. It wasn't just city cops, but it was also federal officials. And you can bet that on the corners of every major downtown building, there were sharpshooters, there were intelligence gathering people. A small group of mask-wearing, black-clad people would be the easiest group to take out strategically. The fact that the authorities never did that made a lot of people suspect that they were agents provocateurs, that they were, you know, either infiltrated by the police or acting on their behalf. A lot of other observers during the day of November 30th came to the conclusion that they may not have been official provocateurs, but they were sure useful to the cops. From the repeated patterns that we all witnessed, several peaceful protesters actually urged the authorities to come over and arrest people who were clearly doing great deals of damage. They wouldn't be moved in many cases. It seemed to be, from all observations, in the interests of the authorities to have some sort of property damage that could be blamed on the protesters, something colorful in the media that could be seen as a threat. And whether or not that worked to their benefit in the long run, it was sure a tactic that served their interests at the time.
That was S.W. Konser, KABU reporter and program host. I also saw the police ignore Black Bloc protesters who were breaking windows within 50 feet of the police's position. The police made no move to stop them. They appeared to be far more interested in lobbing tear gas at the lockdown affinity group members who were holding an intersection. Was this because the police saw the window breaking as serving to discredit the protests, or because they were making a serious push to open the intersection? I don't know. The music group Blue Scholars put their memories of that day in Seattle to music.
No sunshine. Yo, the body rock stop. probably got caught by the cops nearby. Somebody got shot, but parties don't stop and the parties don't care. It's a stick up, it's why we got our hands in the air, still demanding a share. Refrigerators bare, cause they wanna see trade get free and not fair. But we are not blind, we are not there. We don't got time left to spare to not care. On the last day of November, swelling in ranks, went to chant down the mighty IMF and World Bank. A gathering of people in peaceful assembly, onward to Westlake to disrupt the entry. Walk along steady, riot squad ready to protect every last dignitary's ass. But this started when they herded us like cattle in a fence. Protesters getting restless without an exit, they threatened to arrest us. We pushed back and then a hail of rubber bullets hit teens and old men. I admit, had to split when the first gas canisters hit. Felt it burn in my eyes, nose and lips. They try to blame it on the anarchist garbage. I was there, I'll tell you right now, the pigs started it. But they distorted in the news, talking about stomping down Nike Town, wearing they shoes. But the body rock stopped, probably got caught by the cops nearby. Somebody got shot, but parties don't stop and the parties don't care. It's a stick up, it's why we got our hands in the air. 50,000 deep, and it sound like thunder when our feet pound streets. 50,000 deep, and it sound like thunder when our feet pound streets. 50,000 deep, and it sound like thunder when our feet pound streets. 50,000 deep, 50,000 deep.
That was Blue Scholar and their song, 50,000 Deep. At the end of November 30th, 1999, I sat in a square in downtown Seattle. The sun had begun to set and the town was emptying. Many were sure the police would up the ante under the cover of darkness. I looked at the skyline with tear gas lifting like fog over the skyscrapers and debris filling the streets. I could see broken windows from where I sat. And I knew in that moment that all around the world, people would know that here in the heart of the U.S. empire, there are people who say no, we don't consent. Were all of the tactics used necessary to have that kind of impact? Does the cruel impact of U.S. economic and military imperialism on poor people all around the world call for those kinds of tactics? Would the media coverage of the protests have been better, worse, or maybe not at all, if there had not been direct action or property damage? What about police violence? Would it have been so over the top if only permitted activities were carried out? These and other questions are still being debated about Seattle. In the 10 years since Seattle, protest tactics and government tactics have continued to change. There was no one consensus among protesters on what happened in Seattle. Activists went home and carried on in hundreds of different groups. Anarchists and others developed new tactics as circumstances changed. What follows is a segment from a 2004 indie media interview of anarchists from La Commune in Montreal, Canada. They talk about giving up the black bloc tactic of secret meetings and anonymous actions involving property destruction.
I think too that one reason that make people gradually leave the black bloc tactic was repression, because in Montreal, we have a history of mass arrest, since 2000, I guess, since May Day 2000, where 157 people were arrested. After that, it was more and more people. Even on March 15, 2002, it was 371 arrests. So they circle everybody, and you just charge after, and you have years and years in trial, and I guess that the people I know that kind of try to use that still black bloc tactics today, and they are alone in their corner asking for people, come, we're gonna smash the window, and nobody wants to go. They've never been arrested yet, so it's more easier when you don't have criminal record to go do your stuff and then run. But then when you are trapped into that 4 years trial or whatever, and then you can't cross the border as NIFAC, we're in Quebec but also in the United States, so if you can't cross the border you can attend meetings. And so I guess that for us, I think it was one reason to leave black bloc tactics, repression.
Do you think that the backflow tactics ever actually worked, like in your own terms? If you were to do it all again, would you do it?
There are definitely some high points. I was at the protest against the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C. in April of 2000. And, like, that was, like, I guess the next big anti-globalization protest after Seattle in North America. And that at that time, we, I guess what you can call the pre-NEFAC, which was, like, the, I guess the same collectives that eventually became NEFAC, but we weren't organized much as a federation at that point, but the collectives from the East Coast of the U.S. and Canada or decided to call for a revolutionary anti-capitalist black bloc, you know. And I think it's probably one of the largest anarchist contingents I've been in my life. It was like 1,500 to 2,000 people, and we started off like smaller at the beginning of the day, and during the day more and more people joined us because it was part of like a larger protest where there were 20 to 30,000 people or maybe a bit more. And that was successful because we're important enough that the rest of the left, I guess the more moderate left who were organizing the protests, couldn't ignore us. And not myself, but people living in the U.S. were invited to planning meetings, and they had their part in planning the larger protest. And that day, the tactic wasn't to like just do property damage or anything. The tactic was to help the nonviolent protesters. Because at that time, it was very popular to do like lockdowns. So the strategy was to try to close the city with people blocking street corners and like linking arms, locking down. And so when police would try to disperse the nonviolent protesters, well, we would confront the police on the front line. So and. It was neat because, like, it was pretty successful, and at the end of the day, like, you had, like, all these nonviolent protesters cheering us on, and they were happy we'd prevent them from getting arrested.
And I think, too, that at least in North America, when Black Bloc tactics in that big protest start, it makes the anarchists alive again. Because you don't have this long tradition as you have in Europe of anarchism. And that in those summits, you know, like anarchists were in all newspaper. Mm-hmm. And so that just make people, oh yeah, anarchists exist. And anarchism was viewed as the main political force behind those action. So that was great too, because behind those action was you know, a basic discourse that I can say against capitalism, you know, and that's it was new too, you know, to talk about capitalism and not only like neoliberalism, you know, that the roots of the problem was capitalism. And I think it was a good point.
That was an excerpt of a 2004 Indie Media interview of members of the La Commune organization in Montreal, Canada. The debate over what tactics are appropriate in these kinds of protests still goes on, as it should. After all, as Dave Rovick says, we just want the world. This is Linda Olsen-Osterlin for KBOO Radio.
When we're living in the White House and debating on the Hill, of all your crazy antics, we'll all have had our fill. We'll be closing down munitions plants, and Old Glory will be furled. Cause we don't want your big machines, we just want the world. And a bill will be proposed, section number one. We're shutting down the oil rigs and turning towards the sun. The air will be clean for all the boys and girls, cause we don't want your oil tankers, we just want the world. Face the executioner, shut the logging camps all down, get busy planting hemp, leave the trees there in the ground. Life is too precious on this little spinning pearl, 'cause we don't want your bulldozers, we just want the world. We'll be closing down the jails and fixing up the schools, distributing those stocks and bonds, changing all the rules. We'll elect a CEO, maybe a rabbit or a squirrel, 'cause we don't want your money, we just want the world. Be swimming in the rivers and running to the hills, reading in the history books of wars and oil spills. If it's linear, we'll bend it. If it's a straight line, it'll curl. 'Cause we don't want your dead-end highway, we just want the world. When we're living in the White House and debating on the Hill, of all your crazy antics, we'll all have had our fill. We'll be closing down munitions plants, and Old Glory will be furled, 'cause we don't want your big machines, we just want the world.